Good evening, everyone. I wanted to speak about one of the interesting halachic issues, really one of the more fascinating halachic topics in terms of the evolution of practice in Machlokes. I'm not sure if there's any lumdus in this sugya, but if there is, it won't be in tonight's year. But I do want to speak about it, so far, really not from that perspective, but from more of a strict halachic perspective, to understand what the issue is of what we colloquially refer to as Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin, what's the difference between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, and why there are different practices in terms of whether people wear or don't wear, and how should they wear Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin. The connection to the Parsha really comes towards the end of the Parsha, as you know, in Perek Yud Gimel, really with it's really the last group of psukim, but we'll read a handful of them just specifically. So the Torah tells us in Pasuk Tes, specifically in Perek Yud Gimel, a reference to Tefillin V'hayu L'chol Os Al Yadecha U'Zikaron Bein Einecha. That's a reference we understand to the Tefillin. The Os Al Yadecha is a very famous and important pasuk. And then two psukim later in Pasuk Yud Aleph, we have the beginning of one of the Parshios, which we'll see in a moment, one of the Parshios which is in the Tefillin. V'hayu Ki V'yacha Hashem El Arz Haknani Kasher Nishva Al V'Secho U'Nasana Lach. And it's not a lach, the parsha about Hashem telling you that I'm going to bring you into Eretz Yisrael, and then Hashem gets into Petarechem and Bechor, and then once again in the end, the last pasuk in the Torah again, the famous phrase, again a second reference now to the Tefillin. So you have Tefillin really suffusing these last 7-8 psukim, and specifically in that unit of pasuk Yud Aleph, you have what's known as the parsha of Vahaya Ki Yivyacha. In fact, the Mishnah in Masechta Menachos and Daf Ches Amud Aleph tells us that the Tefillin, both the Tefillin Shel Yad and Tefillin Tzorosh, are made up of four different Parshios. The Gemara tells us, commenting on that Mishnah, there is a fundamental difference between the two. Tefillin Shel Yad are on one parchment and in one bias, and the Tefillin Shel Yad, are in four different parchments and in four different sub-compartments. But basically, it's the exact same parshios. And the Gemara there in Masechta Menachos and Daf Lamed Aleph Beis identifies these parshios as starting with Shmos Perek Yud Aleph. Excuse me, Yud Beis. Also from my parsha, Pasuk Yud. Excuse me, Pasuk Aleph. Excuse me, no, that's the wrong one. Well, anyway, I'm sorry. We have, of course, the various parshios which are in the Tefillin. We have, again, the two from our parsha, and then, of course, we have the Shema and the Vahaya in Shemoah. There's also, the Rambam quotes this halacha as well, in Hechos Tefillin, right in the beginning, in Perek Aleph, Hecha Aleph, and the basic halacha of the four parshios, the Shulchan Aruch quotes in the beginning in Siman Lamed Beis. There is a halacha which is quoted by Chazal, it's in the Mechilta and our Parsha originally, and that is that because these psukim are mentioned in obviously in a sequence in the Torah, so too they must have ksiva kesidron. The Parshas have to be written by the Sofer in the order that they are written in the Torah. The question which is now before us, which is at the heart of the sugya of what's known as Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin or Rashi Tefillin, is that halacha, which is not debated, that you need to have right the tefillin in the order that they're in the parshios of the Torah, does that also govern the order that they are placed in the bottom of the tefillin? They have to be written in order, so they also have to be placed. Now, logically, you would expect that that is what would be done. And in fact, the Rashi, famously in the Gemara there, tells us, in fact, that the order of the tefillin in the bottom follows the order that they're written, which follows ultimately the order that they're presented in the Torah. Tosfos there on that Gemara quotes a number of things, but including, first and foremost, most notably, the famous Shita of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam argues, what is the Machlokes? The Machlokes is about Parshios 3 and 4, or Shema and Vahayim Shemoah. So Rashi understands that they go in order from Shmos through Dvarim, and the last, therefore, one in the Batim is Vahayim Shemoah. The third one is Shema. Rabbeinu Tam inverts those two. So that you have Shema coming last, and you have in the middle, you have the Vahayim Shemoah. That is the basic machlokes between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. You get it right on the page there in Masechta Menachos. So let's take each one of these shitos one by one, because we will see, even in terms of identifying the machlokes, not only is this not just machlokes Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, but there are many Rishonim in both directions. We will see that there are even earlier sources that address this even before the Rishonim, again, even though it's known in this way. So, for example, Tosfos quotes a Mechilta, also from our Parsha, which seems to be the Farish, seems to be at least like Rashi. Furthermore, there's a Medrash Tanchuma on our Parsha that seems to be like Rashi. And when it comes to the Rishonim, you do sometimes see this referred to as not only Rashi Shita, but also the Rambam. The Rambam in the Chosfilin and Perek Gimel Halacha Hey, the Farish like Rashi. And not only is it just those two, you have the Rambam, the Shuvas HaRashba in his own name, and in the name of Rabbeinu Yonah. Many Rishonim, perhaps Mamari Chazal, Midrashim, all indicating what you would otherwise assume to be the Halacha, that is, that they're written, in the placed in the bar, in the Parsha, the Bakim, the same way they're written in the Torah. However, as I mentioned, we know we have this alternative Shita, the Shita of Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam, as I said, is not alone. For example, Rabbeinu Tam is quoted also in the Tosfos there, also to be agreeing, really, with someone who came before him, most notably Rav Haigon. And there you have almost a little bit of a mnemonic, as well as perhaps a svara, for why you would invert the order. The Rav Haigon is suggesting that you should have the Havayos next to each other. What are the Havayos? V'haya kiyaviyacha and v'haya im shemala. So those, quote-unquote, Havayos should be together in the middle, and that's why he switches them. That's the way the quote, at least the mnemonic, certainly to remember. Furthermore, if you take a look in the Mordechai, in the end of Masechta Menachos, you have the Rosh and the Mordechai and others, not writing so much on the Gemara, but you have what their Halachos Sukos, in this case, on Hilchos Tefillin. Organized, you have the Rosh has Hilchos Tefillin there, and Hilchos Tam, and the Mordechai does as well. If you take a look at the Mordechai, not only does he quote Rav Haigon, he's also a Shri Ragon, and the Rif, and Rabbeinu Hananel, all agreeing with Rabbeinu Tam. Right? This is a major battle royal. Right? It's not just Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, you have major other Rishonim and earlier sources on both sides. So what's interesting is that I met... No, this is not the Farish in the Gemara. What's Beferish in the Gemara is they have to be written in order. Ksiva Kesidron. It's maybe implied, but it's definitely open. It's definitely open from our Gemara. And we'll see, in fact, that there are some who justify the hedging because of that. So sort of Vajra makes that point in the Tshuva. But,
each one has a
color. It's a lot of Svara, So for example, so some are leaning on the Sur of Haigon, for example, and I mentioned that that's quite a number of Rishonim. Yet the Rambam has a well-known tshuva to the Chachmei Lunil. They ask them lots of things. And one of the things is they're very critical of the Rambam for wearing Rashi tefillin. I don't know if he called it that. they probably call it Rambam tefillin in his day. So why was the Rambam wearing Rambam tefillin? After all, you have these Makaros against you, and Rav Haigon is against you. So the Rambam writes a number of very interesting things back to them. One of which is that he says, in fact, I don't know exactly what the historical origins or veracity of this is, but the Rambam writes in a tshuva that they went badku the tefillin of Rav Haigon. They found the tefillin of Rav Haigon, and they opened them. It's not an archival story. This is in a tshuva of the Rambam. He says they opened up the tshuva of Haigon's tefillin. I said like Rashi. Again, he lived well before Rashi, but you understand what I'm saying. Also, in this idea, so all the Rishonim are claiming that Rav Haigon was like Rabbeinu Tam. Taka, we looked, and sure enough, Rav Haigon's fill-in are like Rashi. Furthermore, he asked for a source. So the Rambam quotes that there was a girsa of the Gemara which is explicit, like Rashi approach. And yet, as the Kesef Mishnah already points out, we don't have that Nusach of the Gemara. There's a lot, that's why I say it's a fascinating sugya, for on the one hand, it's so ubiquitous, it's something that we're doing 6 days a week, and on the other hand, it's so shrouded in mystery. It's not, you would think, Louis, that there's like this very firm footing. It's not like that. It's much more shifting sand, the sugya. And that's why you have so many shitas, so to speak, on both sides. Furthermore, adding to the, not the machlokas, but more to the mystery, to the intrigue, So we don't know what Rabbi Nahigon did. And just if you should think that this sounds like crazy, like we're checking people's fill-in, just so you should know, I don't know if anyone checked it or not. But you know, for example, Lamoshal, like they talk about, I don't know where it is or where they found it. You know, every now and then you have people talking about the Chavetz Chaim's Kiddush Cup. Right? That they want to be prove what the shear of a Kazayas is based on apparently the fact that he had a very small Kiddush Cup. Well, I'll tell you another interesting thing. I don't know if it's true or not, but when I lived in Riverdale, so one of the Bacharim, actually, I think it was, if I remember correctly, I think it might have been the Rosh Shiva's sons, came over to me to say, they asked me if I know the Rav's son, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. I said, I was once in his class, I was scared, and I'm still scared. So I technically know him, but I don't really know him. Why do you ask? And he happened to live in Riverdale. Well, we heard he has Rav Chaim's tefillin. There's this Masora, there's this Yeshiva Shashprach, that Dr. Soloveitchik has Rav Chaim Brisker's tefillin. Maybe you could help us, we want to see. I said, I can't help you, sorry. I don't know if he has them, but I can't help you. I wish there's another chapter of that story, it ends right there. I just give you a step, but I'm just telling you, it's not as crazy as it sounds, you know, for what, you know, Rav Chaim was a gain, and Rav Chaim was a gain. Right, so it's Rav Chaim gain. So they went and they found Rav Chaim Gon's film. Those Yeshiva Bacharim had more success than the Sal's Yeshiva Bacharim did. But maybe it'll work. Listen, I bet if we would have knocked on Dr. Soloveitchik's door, I would have told him the story, which I'm sure he's not that aware of. And, you know, we want to check his film. Anyway, but to add another layer to the intrigue, the Ravid and other Rishonim, the Ravid agrees against the Rambam here, and like Ravid's on the Rabbeinu Tam camp. So the Ravid and other Rishonim quote a girsa of the Talmud Yerushalmi in the Sefer Menachos, in a kutchim, which they say is explicit like them. What's the problem? There is no Yerushalmi. We don't have Yerushalmi on kutchim. The Ravid says there was, well, I'm sure he had something, but we don't have it anymore. We don't have it anymore. And the truth of the matter is I'm not an expert on this. In fact, it's funny, because someone was just telling me that Dr. Schneer Lyman was a scholar in residence in a shul, and the topic that he spoke about, at least on one of his discussions, was the fact, and I just was reading about it in light of this, that in the beginning of the 20th century, I think it was 1905, there was a claim that spread through Europe, someone produced. Look. Huh? I know he wasn't the one who produced. I mean, a lot of Gedolim got caught up in this. But there was somebody who came forward and said that he had found the Yerushalmi on Kutchim. And there were many, many Gedolim who absolutely believed in it. I believe they say that it was the Ger Rebbe who never bought into it, and eventually, or one of the Rebbe, anyway, Lamaisa eventually became known to be a fraud. But we'll see as we come to this year. The Chavetz Chaim was very taken by this. The Chavetz Chaim was his son in his biography. The son wrote a biography of the Chavetz Chaim. And the son writes to how his father was very taken by this. So, after all, we have the Ravid's, you know, we never knew what the Ravid was talking about. Now we'll have a Kutchim, a Yerushalmi Kutchim, that says that we should put Rabbeinu Tam's filling on. So you have, as I say, it's not just a machlokas. It's not an ordinary machlokas. You have all these different layers of intrigue surrounding this machlokas, which you don't, you know, as I say, typically find. So Lamaisa, you have this major machlokas. What were people doing? What were people doing? So it's interesting, the smag, the way he puts it is, Lamaisa, there's a lot of shitas on both sides. He says it's already in the Rishonim period, he says it's already universal to go like Rashi. His lashon is in Eretz Edom and in Eretz Yishmael, that's his term. Those are his terms, in Eretz Edom and Eretz Yishmael, meaning Ashkenaz and Sephardim. They're all holding like Shitas Rashi. And in fact, he and other Rishonim tell a following story. If you want a more accessible place, if you open up a tour Beis Yosef, you take a look at the Drisha, which is on the bottom of the pages of the tour. He also tells this story in the Bach. They all discuss the story. So depending on where you see, some speak about they stumbled over a certain grave. Again, the story just gets, this is a unique sugya. We've got Rav Haigon's tefillin, we've got pseudo Yerushalmi's, and now you have the story that the Smag tells over, the Jerisha mentions, where eventually they somehow did some excavations and they uncovered an ancient grave. Or the way the Smag puts it, he talks, the way I understand him, he's describing the kever of Navi Yechezkel. Rav Haigon's not early enough, we got to go back. That the kippah, I think that I mean, like the grave somehow collapsed and they had to re-excavate it. This is quoted by Rishonim and Poskim and Shulchan Aruch on tour. And sure enough, in the kever of Yecheskel, they found the tefillin. I guess his grave was his tefillin. Also like Rashi. So you have another, you know, as I say, not your typical riots that are being thrown around here. You know, I hear you're a high goat, and I will match you with a Chevri Heskel.
Well, we don't know that the high goat didn't also have a second pair of
tefillin. So, oh, very good. So the Bach. About the Rav Haigon, I don't know about, but this story about the Kever and the ancient excavation, the Bach says a better word. The Bach says, maybe that's not a Raya for Rashi. On the contrary, why was this buried? Maybe they were gonazed because it's wrong. Maybe that's a Raya that Fakert, that Halach is like Rabbeinu Tam. Why else did they bury? Who buried Tfilin? They bury Rashi Tfilin.
Listen, not listen. I mean, it was buried
listen. I'm not Indiana Jones. You need it. You need him for that. I don't know. I happen to have this. I don't know. I'm sure there could be the others. And certainly in Eretz Yisrael, there are plenty. But there's actually, you don't see too many from archaeologists in America, at least. In Eretz Yisrael, you have some. There's one of my family's very good friends when I was growing up in Cincinnati is a well-known archaeologist. His expertise has to do with, I think, Troy and not this. But I would be curious, you know, for what he knows about this. He's a very famous archaeologist. It's also the raya that real archaeologists don't wear cool leather coats and fedoras and swing by ropes. So he was a little bit of a nerdy guy. But anyway, be that as it may, he's a wonderful friend of my family. So you have this, you have another layer of this, you know, wild sugya, so to speak, where you're back and forth about not arguing in lumdis, arguing in excavations and graves. I mean, what's going on? Wild, wild stuff. The Aruch HaShulchan calls the story of the of Yechezkel. It's just wild. Bottom line, you have these shitas flying around, these rayas. If you take a look at most of these Rishonim, it seems to be very clear implicitly, and in even more cases explicitly, it's a zero-sum game. And this is really what I want to move into next. The pashtus, like you have by most machloksim, but this is clearly not your average machlokas, so we have to point this out if we're going to make the assumption, is that if you believed in Rashi's tefillin, then somebody who wore a Benet Tam's tefillin was mevatel mitzvas aseh. They have nothing. It's garnished. And if you believe Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, then all of us this morning who just put on Rashi's tefillin, nothing for nothing for nothing. You can spend your whole life never fulfilling a tefillin once. Nothing. Garnished. And that's the pashas of the Rishonim, that it's like you could imagine, almost like any other machlokas. I'll give you a lamashal where you see this clearly in a more recent tshuva. The Shvas Yaakov discusses, what if you'll have your shal yad like one, and your shal rosh like the other? Could you do such a thing? He says, mikra din, you're not yotze at all. Because mamonoshach, it's a stira. But he then says, well, maybe b'shas atchak you could be, because in shas atchak, anyway, there are poskim that say you can rely just on having one. You can just have shal yad. But really, really, he's very against such a thing. You might have thought, I'll hedge my bets, I'll wear both. In that regard, they were both, and he's very against it. Again, and the point is, in his discussion, his analysis, he's clearly he's assuming that it's one or the other.
But the hedge is really good for our
boat. Oh, well, we'll have to, that's what we're getting to. Now, one of the things which you see, and this is, I came across an article written by a professor from Bar-Ilan University, and he made this tushtel. But before I mention the tushtel, it's just like an obvious, it's like such a bizarre thing to have a machlokas about. I don't know if you've ever thought about this before. But I mean, like, when did this machloket, like, they had put on tefillin every day.
When did the
Tagayim? What were they doing? What was Yechezkel doing? I mean, it may be weird to dig up his grave, but it's not weird to ask the question. Like, when all of a sudden you have such a machloket like this? I mean, it's like a wild thing. So, nevertheless, whatever the explanation is, the pashtus is, most of the Rishonim is that somehow they were always doing one, yet there's a shita out there somehow, golus, who knows what. Oh, very good. So what's an example? What's the example that really is similar to this, where it's just hard to imagine? So sure enough, Alan and this professor from Bar-Ilan both made the tushtel, and if Haigon, if I'm not mistaken, plays a prominent role there too, is shofar. In other words, what the tekios are supposed to be, how do we get to 30, right? What shvarim was trua, all that kind of stuff, right? So we know originally the Gemara didn't have not even close to 100 kolos, right? Basic 9, we don't know. Misafik, it sounds like Rav says, with the Gemara, and it's a famous point made by Rav Haigon, where he said, no, it wasn't really that way, because how you talk to Rav Haigon, the Kribbit of Machlokas, that had to blush over. What were they doing all the years? All of a sudden, the time of the Amorim, that a Machlokas, what did they do before that? So, you see that somehow is explicit in Rishonim, or Gaonim, even about Shofar. But you don't have that. In other words, that's the closest case of something so essential to Yiddishkeit, that you can have such a basic Machlokas about, But at least there, at least if you accept Rav Haigon's approach, that's where he claims it really wasn't a machlokas, it really wasn't a confusion, they always knew it was just maybe a sidur.
Don't some people say either way was correct?
Yeah, that's what Rav Haigon, yeah. Alan, you're mamish on fire tonight. Because I want to say that that's the pashtus is, that it's really a machlokas, and however the machlokas emerged, it's just a mystery. But there's been a lot of mysteries in the sugya. However, as Alan suggested, there is another approach. But this approach is found almost exclusively in mystical sources. But there's a bevy of mystical sources that want to claim, in a certain sense, akin to the shofar idea, it wasn't really a machlokas. How could it be a machlokas? Elamai, this is perhaps more so than any other example, mamish, they're both true. Mamish, elu ve'elu devei kleim chayim. So, for example, the Arizal is quoted by a number of poskim, the Ben Ish Chai and others. Ben Ish Chai writes, I used to think this was a regular machlokes. You know, I don't know which one's right, but one of them. Then I saw the Arizal, and the Arizal says this is mamish, this is the definition of elu ve'elu. These are both kadosh, they're both right. And if you want to go even further back, both historically and in terms of like how extreme you want to be, some of you may know from the Valiatosis there's a sefer called the Tshuvas Min HaShamayim. One of the Valiatosis had this, basically published a sefer in which the premise of the sefer is that he had a dream, and that Hashem came to him in a dream and gave him all sorts of psukim, and he published them. You can buy it in a safe form store. Masar of Kot published it, I think it was Rav Margolius who was going to put out the critical edition, called Tshuvas Min HaShamayim. And historically, throughout the modern poskim, there have been, you know, are we allowed to use such a sefer? What about Lo B'Shamayim? But that's the name of the sefer, Tshuvos Min HaShamayim. Rav Avadya Yosef has a whole tshuva where he discusses not only in the context of tefillin, but he discusses in general what role does such a sefer play in halacha. But Lamaisa, in that sefer, one of the things he talks about is tefillin. And there is a Siman Gimel of that sefer, and he goes so far, apparently the Malach, whoever spoke to Hashem, told him, not only was this an Elu V'Elu Machlokes in this world, it's a Machlokes B'Mesifta D'Rakia. Even Klape Shmaya, they don't have a clear Hachra, which is another way of saying, you know, in the highest of the high, they're mamish both true. It's not a typical Machlokes, it's not a zero-sum game, one or the other. Mamish, they're both true. And in fact, the Ben Ish Chai suggests to our question of new, what did they do? So the Ben Ish Chai says, quote meaning I'm paraphrasing in English, but he says that from the time of Moshe to the time of the Gaonim, they wore two.
Same time.
That's what he said. Well, the same time or one after the other, we'll get to in a second, but yeah, I would assume he means the same time. Ben Ish Chai. The Ben Ish Chai, he quotes the Arizal, the Sefer Min HaShamayim, there's this whole tradition. So, fascinating. Again, not your typical sugya in that regard. So, after all is said and done, a major machlokes is that I'm... Huh? That's what it seems like he said. Most Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what he said, yeah. So we can call it Moshe Rabbeinu tefillin, not Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. It's Moshe versus Aaron. Who said it's all Moshe Sinai? Okay. Again, that's the point, according to this idea. It's not one or the other, we're just not sure. Clarification is not relevant. They're both true. There's some mystical reason why you'd want to have both. That's the assumption of this school of thought. So now, bottom line, what? So now what is already addressed explicitly by the Rishonim? And one of the earliest is the Smag, but really the Tashbates, others, they're already in the Rishonim, they point out that because of this, so we don't know it's not like a normal machlokas. How do you navigate such a machlokas? They said, because of this, a Yarei Shemayim should wear both. The Tashbates, for example, attests that the Marami Rutenberg, one of the greatest Gedolei Ashkenaz, wore both. What did they mean, wore both? Here they clearly mean they're talking about at the same time. Shal Yad at the same time, Shal Rosh at the same time. In fact, the Rosh, I mentioned to you, not only the Mordechai, also the Rosh has what he calls his Hilchos Tefillin, and in Halacha Hay, he says it's such a big machlokas, therefore you should wear both. It happens to be, as wild as this sounds, if you're familiar with this Gemara in Erevin, the Daf Yomi learners or others who may have learned Erevin, I'm Daf Tzadi Hei, where the Gemara in Erevin assumes that there is enough room, on the head and on the arms for two tefils of tefillin. Now it is worth noting, and we'll get back to this soon, the Tosas right on that Gemara says, you see, they must clearly have had smaller tefillin than ours. It's hard for us to imagine how we could wear two. And in fact, already the Red Vaz has a tshuva where he discusses, you know, how is this possible to wear two at the same time? Lamaisa, there's two issues. One is the room, because as you know, there's a place on the arm, especially a place on the head, where you have to wear tefillin, and if you're not wearing it in the right place, you're not going to see anyway. That's one problem, potentially, with this. So one thing, this, you know, chumra mivi li dekula. A bigger problem, a bigger kula, if you will, is it could be mamash and aveira, which is the aveira called? Baltosif. So the Rosh, and some of the will, if you will, the more halachic, strictly halachic-oriented mefarshim, are very much choshish to that. So how do you get out of the Baltosif problem? So there seems to be two approaches, and it's not a Baltosif issue now, but this is very relevant to the meta-Baltosif issue. Some mefarshim seem to say that you don't have a problem, because Baltosif has certain technical parameters. If you would put a fifth bias in one of the tefillin, that would be. But you do two things completely, the two separate cheftas, or even zebuzeb, but there's two separate objects, that's not called baltosif. Yet it's clear that the Rosh at least was choshesh that that's not going to help you. That maybe there really is a baltosif problem if you wear them. Therefore, the Rosh suggests, and this is what you'll see quoted in the Bir Halacha and Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Berurah, that goes all the way back to this Rosh, and maybe even the Smog, if I remember correctly, but the Rosh for sure says it, you should do it with a tznai. You should put them both on with a tznai, whichever one is true. It's correct. That's my tefillin. And the other ones are just straps following them. And they suggest that that helps you get. You're not redefining the mitzvah. You're not adding to the mitzvah. I'm just not sure.
That doesn't help according to those who hold it.
Oh, very good. Very good. And the Bir Halacha has right maramis to that. So basically, that whole chumrah, according to the others, it doesn't, it's not, it's bechlal, not necessary. And that's just, and it's, but it's also, it's not, not only does that solve the problem, but better, there is no problem. They're both true. Exactly the point. So if you look in the Shari Tshuva, and they also quote from the Radvaz, they point out that from the Arizal and the Mekubalim, who believe that this is really an Eilu Be'eilu Machlokes, therefore that's why we say to wear both, but that's also why there won't be any problem with Eilu Be'eilu. So you have, there's two reasons to wear both. One is this Mekubalim type approach, and the other one is to say, no, listen, this is a regular old Machlokes, like anything else, but this is important mitzvah, it's a Machlokes Rishonim, so no, let's be Machmir, let's wear both. Now, on the issue of...
the room bothers me, but could you wear one on top of the other? That would not be a hesed,
I don't, so. Yes, well, why, because Minda Mino?
One rush on top of the other.
That's not on your head. I have a hard time believing that would work. And that's not how they're describing it.
Were they next to each other or behind
it? One
that's behind
it.
I said they were smaller than behind it.
I, in my mind's eye, I have to be honest with you, I've never seen this. Yes, I'm going to get to it. I've never seen it. So where? How did you see it, Louis? The Shel Rosh was behind, one behind?
No,
you saw next. You saw behind. Right. Okay, so in my mind's eye, I imagined it as behind. But I have to be honest with you, I never saw it before. Lamaisa, there are others who discuss, Rav Avadji has a number of tshuvas about this. It's interesting, Rav Moshe has two big tshuvas about this. I didn't have a chance to read them, but a lot of them are heavily about the Baltosif issue, and I did notice that one of them was to the Lubavitch Rebbe, which was poetic. Because obviously we know that the only Ashkenazi group that main, you know, that pushes this is Lubavitch. Lamaisa, that is the general approach you see from the Rishonim. However, it's clear that already in the Shulchan Aruch, Minhag Ashkenaz, perhaps because of the Baltosif problem, or at least, if not more likely, because of this idea that our tefillin are bigger and there's just simply no room. So already the minhag evolved what Rav Avadja calls minhag Ashkenazim, where Rav Avadja actually endorses this. We'll see that the other Sephardic posting don't like Rav Avadja for this. But this is one of those rare times where Rav Avadja says we should follow the Ashkenazic practice of wearing them one after the other. But again, Rav Avadja does say you should wear both. But he says you should wear them one after the other. All of this would imply, if we would stop here, that all of us should be doing all of this. So how come there's anyone in the room who wears a Ben Adam tefillin? Anyone in this room who's ever put on a Ben Adam tefillin? Okay, so we're up the creek. So that's why you have to read the next halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. The next halacha in the Shulchan Aruch is based on a Maharil. The Maharil is already quoted by the Beis Yosef that says, only a big tzaddik, only someone who's known to be a big chassid, only somebody like that should wear both pairs of tefillin. But otherwise, if you're just a regular old plain Jane, then you should just wear Rashi tefillin. This is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Lamed Daled Seif Gimel. And the Mishnah Brura points out, which seems to be from earlier sources from this Maril, that since really it's so obvious that the Machlok, the Pesach is like Rashi, so to wear anything else, that's already some kind of a, what we call in Halacha, a Mechzei Kiyura.
Rabbi, I once heard a story that they said about the Chofetz
Chaim. I'm going to get to the Chofetz Chaim, but I want to hear you. What's your story?
The story is that supposedly he started wearing Rabbi Nathan Ben Aaron during his life.
So far, our stories are identical. Next chapter? I'm not up to it yet. Okay. I appreciate your graciousness, Louis. I'd like to think it's because I've been gracious to you over the years. And I will, because we have that kind of relationship, when I tell the story, if there's any way different from what you heard,
I'll be in there.
Okay. I would expect nothing less. So the Radvaz has a tshuva where he's talking about this and he says, you know, I don't think this. What's Yura? We're being Machmir, right? You know, what's wrong with being Machmir? He says, maybe all that meant, to Maril or others, maybe all they mean is if you're wearing both at the same time. That's like a shtickle, fafrumt. But if you're wearing one after the other, you're being Machmir. So the truth is that if you look in the Lashon Shulchan Aruch, Yabiya Omerik also quotes this, but the truth is, that, as Yerav Avadya himself points out, if you look in the Lashon Shulchan Aruch, I don't know what the Maril necessarily had in mind, but the Shulchan Aruch is, I think, clearly not talking just about that. Shulchan Aruch seems to say anything, either not only simultaneously, but even one after the other, is a problem of kind of religious arrogance, what we call Yura, unless you're already known. You're Mefursam as a Chassid, and here Chassid, of course, with lowercase c, and a Tzaddik. We have many people who are doing it who aren't so Mefursam Ketzadikim. And like I said, in certain communities, whether it's in certain Sephardic communities or the Lubavitch community, where every 13-year-old is already putting them on, what's the heter for such a thing? So there are some earlier sources that discuss this. For example, the Berkei Yosef, the great Sephardish posek, so he points out something which we have in a number of areas of halacha. This is one of them, which is that there are often things which are a function of community standards, l'kula or l'chumra. And even though we should either not break from community standards, in this case, not try to be firmer, or sometimes, let's say, in sneas, you shouldn't be less. Even if halacha doesn't require a certain thing, but if in this community, this is what's done, you shouldn't break from it. That we have that concept in both directions. However, in both cases, we also find that these things aren't in stone, because they're based on community standards. So if somebody, and I don't know, it's hard to know exactly where the line is, 2 people, 3 people, 10 people, 30 people, but if some people push the line, so Taka, they were Taka wrong. They were wrong. But they also have an impact. And in not retroactively, but at some point, the line moves. That is a concept in halacha without a doubt. So we have this sometimes in sneeze, right? If a community has a certain standard, so Taka, people should hold to it. But if Lamaisa, 10 people are not holding to it, so again, I don't know where the number is. I'm using 10 as an arbitrary number for now. So Taka, each one of those 10 people did something wrong. But for number 11, it's mutter. It's because it's not a community standard. You can't call it a community standard. So, well, I'm giving the example now in terms of the Sur Meirah, if you will. Let's say, like, I'm giving it as an example of Sneas. But there are certain parts of Sneas which are not objective, they're subjective, community standards. So my point is, let's say 10 people break the standard. Again, I'm using 10, please don't hold me to that number. I don't know where the number is. Maybe it's less than 3, I don't know. But 10, I mean, it's less than 10. But the point is, you could have something where people break that. Taka, they were wrong. They shouldn't have. But it has an impact. So for number 11 through 100, it's no longer, you can't call it community standard anymore. So using that as a mushal, the Berkei Yosef says, and others say as well, it's the same thing here. True community standard, the Shulchan Aruch said, it's mechze ki yura, unless you're before someone like a tzaddik, you shouldn't be putting on tefillin. But lamaisa, if people are doing it, if you go to a shul, if you go to a community and people are doing it, so then you can't, I'm not showing off by doing it. That's what everyone does. It's only when no one's doing it that for me to do would be to show off. So I'm using that other case as an analogy. Let's not be distracted by that. I'm just focusing on this. The point is, you have certain things that are subjective, and those can change. So the Berkei Yosef suggests, even though the Shulchan Aruch says only Mefursim Tzaddikim should do it, so that was either, like the Maril said, limited to when they were doing two at the same time. And even if, though I think that's probably not what the Shulchan Aruch meant, but the Berkei Yosef says, even the Shulchan Aruch would be Moda, that if Lamaisa it's more widespread, whether it should or shouldn't have been, that's not going to affect you or me, so to speak. Once we do it, once we're thinking about whether we should do it or not, then it would be okay. The Shmos Yaakov actually argues, just as an aside, the Shmos Yaakov I don't remember if this is a machlok so much in the Kavanos of Shulchan Aruch, or he just means it himself, that he holds that it doesn't matter that other people are doing it. They're wrong, so two wrongs don't make a right. You know, Shulchan Aruch said, don't try to be such a knocker. So the fact that other people think that they're knockers, you shouldn't do it. A final thing to mention on this balance, which again goes back to our Kabbalist approach, which we saw had nafkaminas. So this is another of those nafkaminas. So for example, the Tshuvas Chaim Sha'al, which is one of the great Svardisha poskim slash mekubalim. So he pointed out that if it would be a regular plain machlokas, which most of the Rishonim seem to assume it is, and we have this overwhelming minhag Yisrael to hold like Rashi, and then who am I? I'm going to be machmir like a Ben Atam. That would have been a mess like you or I. But now, he says that we realize that it's not that kind of a machlokas, but it's this mekubalim idea that really, even in the Sefer Derekia, there's a machlokas, and it's really, like the Arizal said, shnehem emes. So then that's not your road. That's just, again, ultimately almost like Mikra Adin or Mikra HaKabbalah, whatever you want to call it, to do it. So those are three or four different reasons the post can suggest why, at least in certain communities, you can, so to speak, you're not compromising the Shulchan Aruch, either because the Shulchan Aruch wasn't taking into account this approach, or because despite the Shulchan Aruch, it's still okay. With all of that said and done, in 1954, Rav Avadya wrote a tshuva, where he suggests that, in the end of the day, he says, he advocates doing both, but he's a big believer in what he called Minhag Ashkenaz. We should not do them at the same time. We should do them one after the other. His main consideration there seems to be that we're just not going to be able to get them in the right place. However, it's interesting that right after that, another Svardish posek, who was also a shtickle Kabbalist, whose also his first name was Avadya, Rav Avadya Hadaya, which was Yaskil Avdi. He doesn't mention Rav Avadya by name, but I think he's clearly reacting to Rav Avadya, and he's very, very upset. You know, we shouldn't give in at all to Ashkenazim, which is, it's ironic if you're aware, because that's often Rav Avadya's approach. And he often is upset at others, either Ashkenazim meddling in or whatever. Anyway, so, but here the Yaskel Avdi is very upset, and he says that, Taka, we should make smaller tefillin. You know, it's not a rocket science tree. If the tefillin are too big to put in the right place, make smaller tefillin. Who said they all have to be so big? Make smaller tefillin, and that will be able to put them on. And after all, he said, the Kabbalistic approach, he said, makes no sense if you put them on separately. Step again, that's what I'm trying to bring out. That this whole approach of doing one after the other, so if you're machmir because we have a machlokes rishonim, so what do I do? So you do both, one after the other. You would never dream of putting them on at the same time, which is why most of you were imagining that the reason you do it is we're not sure who's right, so we do it after the other. But if you have this whole other Kabbalistic approach, which perhaps some Hasidim do and certainly the Sephardim have, so then, says at least the Rav Avadya Hadaya, it's pointless to do one after the other. It's only this Kedusha of having them mystically together is only if you talk a have. Huh? No, Shariah too. Shariah too. I've never done it, I've never seen it, but I think so. It's interesting that, so why is this not more prevalent in the, if you will, the Lithuanian Ashkenazi community? I think, without being too much of a historian, that the likely explanation is the Vilna Gaon. The likely explanation is the Vilna Gaon. So first of all, the Vilna Gaon and the Bira grew up pasuk like Rashi. Okay, but that's not it. Chiddush, Shulchan Aruch, pasuk like Rashi. However, there is a tradition, there's at least two written sources that I know of, that both tell the same story. Rav Chaim Volozhiner asked, both of them, what's known the Kesarosh and the Maisarav, and maybe a third source, Rav Sternbach is like a great-grandson or great-great-grandson, whatever it is, of the Gra, and one of Rav Sternbach's Svarim is called Hilchos Hagro Umen Hagov, also discusses the story where apparently Rav Chaim Volozhiner went to the Gaon, and he asked him, no, how come we, I think the story goes, maybe he did it once, and then he asked him, you know, shouldn't we be putting on our Bein HaTamfel, and the Gra's apparent response, at least according to one Nosach of the story, is, if you're already going to be machmir, why only wear two pairs? And if you add up the variations, not only of the machlokas here, because there's some other subtle different shitas about the order, but also about the ink, about the writing, about the parchment, the way they categorize it in what's known as the Kesarosh, which was written by a student of the Chaim Volozhiner, 64 pairs of tefillin. The Gra said, well, why two? Wear 64 pairs. Right? What does this remind us of course? Right? Exactly. So, tzitzis, right? Right? There's all sorts of shitas of tzitzis, right? And there's a reason only one got to wear many. Right? For most of us, the Gra's argument is cogent. It's absurd. Why stop there? And no one's going to wear them all. Even the Gra said that. So therefore, Rav Chaim Volozhiner ceased and desisted, and this story has been a very, very powerful Masorah. Now it's interesting that the note of Yehuda has a tshuva where he questions this a little bit, and he says you can't compare, and the Grah pointed out also that in some of these other 64 machlokes, Rabbeinu Tam is a bar plinta too. Even if you want to just say we're machmer like Rabbeinu Tam, but Rabbeinu Tam has other, you know, you have the parshas like Rabbeinu Tam and the Gidim like Rabbeinu. I mean, not only one machlokes in Hilchos Tefillin, there's a lot of machlokes. So my daf in this one, you're going to be machmer for. So the note of Yehuda, at least on that point, he has a tshuva where he says, listen, you can't compare. All these other machlokesim are like the normal machlokesim. But as we saw at the beginning of this year, here, this is not a normal machlokes. You have major, major heavyweights on both sides. You have Noach Hara and the Bavli. You have this pseudo Yerushalmi that the Rishonim seem to have that we don't know where it is. You have excavations of Kfarim. You have machlokesim about Rav Haigon in this tefillin and the Rambam digging up his kefir and all that. This is not a regular machlokes. There's so much heavy, you know, so to speak, star power and so much evidence on both sides that's why this is a unique machlokes. So that's I'm not sure that Nora Venus did it or not. Not that I know of.
But I wonder whether money was a consideration.
Okay, that's also true. Although you could borrow, right? You don't need to own your own phone. You need to put them on yourself. Shneach can't put on his phone for you. I tried that in high school. But, I'm just kidding. I never did. That was just a joke.
Just wondering, they found Sifatari in Qumran, right?
I want you to know. Let me one second. Did I see it? Was it here? I mentioned earlier in the shiur that I found this article from Bar Ilan University, and I think, does he mention that? I saw somewhere that they did mention. I think the answer may be yes, but now I can't remember what they said. Maybe it's not here. Maybe I saw it somewhere else.
What, did they find
the Dead Sea Scrolls? You know, when they did those excavations there. I think I read that somewhere, but I don't remember. It's a good point. Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, it's interesting. Of all topics, this would be the one.
I just have one question.
They do discuss, by the way, I think they also discuss, there's a famous machlokas about whether this is a big issue. This is maybe where I saw this. I didn't, Rabbi Chaim Jachter, who's a Dayan from New Jersey, so he had a few years ago, he's published two Sfarim in English and Halacha. So one of his Sfarim, he had a multi-part series of Halacha, of articles on archaeology and halacha. And if you have archaeological excavations and archaeological finds, does that impact on the halacha or not? So it's a broader issue in general about things that are out of the Masorah than coming in. The Beis Halevi about Radziner Tcheles and different things like that. The Chazon Ish about the Meiri, you know, which we didn't have for hundreds of years. These kind of topics. So on the excavation, specifically about archaeology, he pointed out that they've been, you know, there's a big machlokas about how the mezuzah should be up or. So when we're doing excavations, you know that we know this from when we're in Eretz Yisrael. They didn't have the fancy silver cases. What did they do? They carved it into the doorpost, so you can see was the doorpost horizontal or was the doorpost vertical. So that's the Shiloh. Can you use such information? I think maybe it was in that article somewhere along the lines. I saw someone mention about Qumran, you know, in the Dead Sea Scroll, that whole chevra, what the doorpost looked like, what the tefillin looked like. It's a big question in general whether you can rely on these things. The Chazon Ish has a letter where he's very against it. He thinks it's too speculative. But at least in other contexts, even to be machmir, actually Rav Kook seemed to be machmir for certain things that they found in excavation. So it's an interesting topic. Just to mention a few more things before we finish. 2 minutes. So I'll mention now the story of the Chavetz Chaim, actually. Well, just to mention, bottom line, so Rav Avadya, I had to do this in the beginning of the year, Rav Avadya suggests that perhaps the reason why we have a right to be, so to speak, breaking all these rules or being machmir in ways is because, again, as I said, there's no hachra in the Babli. The Mechilta seems to say one thing, that's clear. There's this Yerushalmi, which we don't even know about or know exists, but the Ravid and others quoted, which did say that, that like Rabbeinu Tam. So that may be another reason why this, so to speak, my focus has come about. There are a lot of, the bottom line, I can't speak necessarily for Sephardim, but at least in Mishnah Berurah, you definitely have a clear sense that, as I said before, whether or not one would also put Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, the mainstream halacha definitely seems to be assuming that, as I said, it's this zero-sum game. It's not this Kabbalistic idea that they're both true. It exists, Rav Avadya. And again, as I say, even if it's not universally accepted, even Rav Avadya seems to take that approach. And that's why, you do see halachos about whether you should have the tefillin in the same bag or not. That's why their makbid have two separate bags. These are all halachos presuming that there's really one correct and there's this additional maybe. Just to end, I did see on two different storybooks. One is called Sefer Chavetz Chaim, Chayavu Po'alo. And then there's another one called the Michtave Chavetz Chaim, which was from Rav Chavetz Chaim's son. And they both more or less told the following story, but with two different explanations. So we'll see which one Louis is familiar with. But the story that they told is that at some point later in his lifetime, the Chavetz Chaim did start wearing Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. So the first one that I heard, which is, if you will, almost the more precious story, is that when they asked the Chavetz Chaim, why are you doing this? He said, listen, I know that I'm towards the end of my life, and I know that when I'll go up to Shemayim, I'm going to see Rabbeinu Tam, and I'm going to talk about all the learning that I did of his Torah, and all the mitzvahs that I did with Shitaso, and then he's going to ask me, Nu, how come you didn't wear my tefillin? And what am I going to be able to say to him? That's from the first story that they said in the Chavetz Chaim. The second story is that he was influenced by this forgery. The second theory was, this is the Chavetz Chaim's son writes. I believe this is what the Chavetz Chaim's son writes. That when this forgery of the Yerushalmi came out, again, the forger may have been a forger, but he was smart. He put in Menachos that it said like a Rabbeinu Tam, because that's how the Rishonim said that there's a Yerushalmi out there. So once he saw that, apparently he was taken by the forgery. So that's when he started wearing it. He didn't stop wearing Rashi Tefillin. He said, oh, I better start wearing it. And the Chavetz Chaim's son writes that even after he became aware, the forgery was uncovered even in his lifetime. I don't know if there's any explanation for it, but once he started, he didn't stop, even after he knew. So two different theories. Not necessarily conflicting, but different theories as to why the Chavetz Chaim might have. I have to take a look again if you're interested. It's in this tshuva. I believe it's the one to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. If not, maybe it's the other one, or Moshe has these two tshuvas. I believe he kind of gives the impression, I didn't have a chance to look at this up again today, that Ramosha himself says, like, basically, you know, whenever I had a chance, whenever I could, whatever that means, that he did. I don't know if other people know or don't know. Maybe Sir Shafford Rottenberg, maybe. I don't know if it's known what Moshe did. But I seem to recall in one of those tshuvas, he was very more open, more receptive to it than I personally would have otherwise guessed. All right, good Shabbos.
When the Rashi